Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 2 of episode 37, where we're discussing an ancient Greek dialogue by Xenophon called Oikonomikos, with our special guest, Professor Peter Adamson of LMU in Munich and the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast. For more information and to get the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now this is part 2 of the episode, so if you haven't listened to part 1 where we introduce the text and the context, you might want to go and do so now. Or don't, it's totally up to you. So last week we talked about the various themes that come up in this dialogue, and we discussed specifically things like the relationship between the shareholders in the business or in the company, in the organization in this case, and the stakeholders, and how Xenophon highlights this debate where the emphasis is, unlike in the contemporary management literature, more on the stakeholders. Specifically, he does so by having Socrates tell Critobulus that the larger the organization and the larger footprint it leaves on the social environment, economically and both in terms of participation, the more it is expected, at least by the ancient Athenian demos, to contribute back to the society. This would normally be done by means of lavish sacrifices and so on, but still it's an important part of cultural development at the time. And interestingly, large households, or as we would be relating them these days, large organizations, were fully expected to participate in that pro rata to their size. And speaking of this, I actually went to look up what the size of a household would be in this time and in this culture. And to my surprise, it's not that small at all. So households could easily go up to 10,000 people, mainly slaves, but still basically 10,000 people of composing them, and have huge swaths of land to cultivate in farming. So these are not small organizations. They're not particularly complex, at least by modern standards, but they're not small. They're rather large, and they can certainly rival some of the biggest organizations we have now. Other themes also included the benefits of gaining first-hand knowledge. So where Socrates recounts his conversation with Ischomachus, that is primarily him going to a person who is considered to be successful in this area of work and basically getting information from them. In addition to this, kind of adjacent to this, there is also the debate on explicit versus tacit knowledge, and how specifically you may know more than you think you do. And Peter pointed out that this is uncommon to this philosophical tradition, as Socrates is famous for going around and showing people of Athens that they know less than they think they do. Well, here, for instance, Ischomachus tells Socrates that and shows Socrates by means of dialectic that simply by observing certain phenomena and around your environment, you can know more, in this case about agriculture, than you would be able to articulate. So there is this hint at the distinction between tacit and explicit knowledge by Polanyi, and this whole stream in knowledge management and the themes about whether codification is really all there is to it, and what is the value of things like practice and application and kind of the more ineffable parts of knowledge that we traced echoes to here. And of course, there's the more perennial questions such as unity of command, different motivational methods, and Ischomachus essentially tells Socrates that you have to be nice to people if you want them to work well, and this is, of course, in later counterposition to such traditions as scientific management, where the material gains and sort of this more mechanistic approach to motivation was made more prevalent than these kind of softer, quote-unquote, more human relations types of motivation, where you recognize people and see what else is going on with them aside from material or financial motivations.
What I was thinking is, when I look at the large organizations that I've been a part of, and I served as about 10 years working as a personal assistant or executive assistant for various senior military leaders, I saw a tremendous parallel. And I guess my read of Economicus was perhaps metaphorical rather than literal. And I saw a big comparison between the purpose of the household and the purpose of the farm. So, and I was thinking about, you know, you take a large organization or a large firm and its production of goods and services. The executive leadership will have certain needs that are to be able to enable the executive to spend the majority of the time taking care of the company's mission or the organization's mission, that you have to have this entity that exists solely to take care of the needs of that executive. In my case, it was, you know, a general officer, and that includes the administrative. It includes personal logistics, transportation. You think about, say, you know, executives in corporate jets or helicopters or, you know, things of that nature. Schedulers, those who basically live and work to make sure that the affairs of the executive are in order so that the executive can concentrate on the organization's mission, which in this particular case is sort of analogous to the farm, which is where you basically are a unit. You're a unit within the city state. I mean, we talked about in part one about this sort of hierarchical relationship from the city state down to the household. And so you look at what sort of purpose does the household or basically the farm serve? That would be basically to help provide the food for the city state. I'm probably going a little bit off of how it was actually done. So Peter, please chime in and correct me. But if you look at it in that way, then a lot of the context of why Escamacus is having this conversation with his wife, who strikes to me like the chief of staff or a fellow executive assistant whose responsibilities are to make sure that this household is run right. Because some of the things that get executives into trouble, things like, you know, misuse of company property or ethical violations or, you know, some of those other things can be, you know, if this household side of things is not doing its job properly, then that definitely comes back on the executive and the executive's ability to function. So that parallel was how I was reading a lot of this discussion about, you know, architecture, with the leader being very hands-on with making sure that the affairs of the farm, you know, internally to the organization are functioning, while the wife or the executive assistant is making sure that everything else is running smoothly in the background.
So, Tom, one thing I was thinking about in it, I think there's this parallel role of the head of the household or the importance of that role. Not only does it give the senior leader or the husband in this case, as Economicus is, the ability to focus on the mission of the organization or the household, but I think it also frees them to focus on what they contribute best, how they add most value to the organization. Because Economicus doesn't talk about, you know, he goes around and does labor like the other people are doing, even though he can do it and has done it. But he talks about how he oversees what they're doing, and he has this instructional role where he's guiding and developing people. And so I think that's also a thing that leaders often miss, is they can do those lower level things, but in these mid to larger organizations, it's an important function for the leader to do, to add value in the way that they uniquely can because of their role.
So if I could just throw in for a second, I think something else that's interesting, I agree with you about the kind of contrast between the married couple in the household being sort of like the steering committee or the executive board, and everyone else is there to kind of follow their directions, right? And that is very much like the general running the army, which is a metaphor we talked about already, or the statesman running the city. I think one of the things that was actually up for debate at this time in ancient Greece is whose benefit this is all for. Because when you read Xenophon, you get a pretty strong sense that everyone else on the estate, which, as you said, could be quite large, is really there to aid the flourishing of the family. So the wife, the husband in the first instance, the wife in the second instance, maybe the children who will inherit the estate. But actually, if you think through the parallel to the state, it would be much more controversial to say that the people who are running the state or the city in the Greek context should be running the city for their own advantage. And in fact, Plato explicitly and very aggressively targets that in, for example, his most famous work, The Republic. He says that the people who run the city are more like shepherds, right, who are looking after the good of the flock.
Right, stewards.
And yes, they're not, yeah, they're stewards, right? And it, and in fact, I think that maybe you can even see glimmerings of this in Xenophon, that there might be an idea here that actually it's not the couple who are supposed to be benefiting. It's not the workers. It's not the slaves. It's not the children. It's in some sense the estate as such, right? So the estate.
Yes, that's what I got. It was this estate, yeah, as a whole that was benefiting, because it's enlarging the estate and it actually benefits the husband and the wife. But it was this larger, they were devoting themselves to this larger thing that actually benefited everybody. So that's why I see, where, right, I see the parallel, think, with the city-state. I think that
there you could draw a parallel to this one way of thinking about modern organizations in the business world, because you do get this, in some ways, kind of weird idea that the executive board and everyone who works for the company are all just there for the benefit of the company. I mean, maybe the stockholders in the last instance, but the shareholders, but in some sense, the company itself, you know, is something that can actually live longer than any human, right? So there are companies around that have longer lifespan than almost anyone else who's alive. And they're these sort of abstract beings that they can have legal rights and responsibilities. And we might think this is a very kind of modern notion that an organization or a business enterprise could have its own good that the people involved in the organization are pursuing. But actually, if you look at Xenophon here, or even if you look at what Plato says about the best city in the Republic, you see that actually these social constructions like cities, households, armies, they can all have their own kind of function and end and their own flourishing, which in some sense is distinct from the flourishing of the people who are involved in it, could maybe pass on from generation to generation. I think it's a very interesting idea, actually. And it's also interesting to think about, should the manager have that objective and end in their mind all the time?
So one thing that occurs to me when you were talking about that, Peter, is the notion of Walmart, as a specific example, serving the larger community. So I'm not defending Walmart, but I'm just saying that some of the themes that you see played out in the context of Walmart and its interactions with society and role in society, you have that one level, people get justifiably concerned about whether the people, the workers in Walmart, are well looked after and are exploited or not valued. And then one of the arguments that you see Walmart and others making is that they're not discounting that. They don't discount it purely, but they say, hey, we serve a larger function for society because we make goods and services available to people at lower cost. And that's a societal good in general, because it raises people's standards of living. And I'm not defending that argument. I'm just saying that is a sort of the other side of the argument that you see, where there's this stewardship of the community role, and many organizations play that up a great deal because it's good for public relations, I admit, but also the way the leaders talk about it, it does seem to be something, a value that they hold dear.
Yeah, I mean, you get a very rosy picture in Xenophon, because Xenophon seems to be committed to the idea that the organization will flourish when everyone who's involved in the organization is as motivated as they could be to make things go well, right? So even the slaves, who, I mean, from our point of view, obviously the slaves are being exploited and deprived of basic human rights. But from Xenophon's point of view, they're slaves. and probably they're not capable of flourishing as independent human beings. He doesn't really get into that in this work, but if you look at what Aristotle, only a generation later, says about slaves, he says some people are just naturally slavish, and it would be bad for them to not have masters because they can't handle it.
Yes. Right?
And if you start from that premise, then you think, well, the best thing for these slaves is to be, is not for them to be exploited, but for them to be used as well as possible. Yeah. And not only just like fed and sheltered, but at least somehow invested in the success of the household. And actually, you know, you could see a more sinister echo of that in modern day life, right? So that you might detect, you know, if you wanted to be less optimistic about Walmart, you might say, oh yeah, well, they use their lower income employees in the only way that they think such people can be used, right? And so both things are there in the ancient Greek
context. Yes, that's the counter argument. I agree. Yeah. And there's some evidence for that.
It's actually really wonderful that you think that the shareholder approach, which is where the purpose of the organization is to generate first and foremost profits to their owners, is kind of the weirder approach of the two, because coming from a business school background, we have to do quite a bit of work to show how the other position makes sense, the stakeholder approach, that where organizations participate in the environment, which they of course cannot do without, and that they have a certain depth of responsibility to that environment and the people who are affected by their activities. But there's an interesting cultural difference coming through here between the ancient Greek polis and kind of the modern capitalist state, and specifically that Xenophon mentions, and as we talked about in the previous part, that larger estates are expected to contribute more to the cultural development of the society, particularly by means of lavish sacrifices and other entertainment ceremonies, which were, of course, a major cultural phenomena at the time, and in a way to worship the gods and increase the state piety, which led to all sorts of good things in the minds of ancient Greeks. And this expectation that people who partake in the organization, most of whom, remember, are slaves, have to work for the benefit of the organization. So looking at this from this more cynical Milton Friedman kind of a shareholder approach, this makes no sense. And why would people who are objectively exploited by the business want to go about their daily lives contributing to that business and expect to be all happy and do so voluntarily and to the best of their abilities? But this is only weird and odd if you think that if you remember that in the contemporary business society, in the contemporary economic order, companies are not expected to contribute to the development of their communities in the same way as the large households were expected to contribute in Xenophon's day, as he conveys through this dialogue. So if a large household or a large corporation actually goes about contributing a share of their profits on a regular basis to the development and the betterment of their immediate environment, it kind of makes more sense that people working for the cause of this corporation would be more willing to put more effort into doing their best, because in an indirect way they are still contributing to the improvement and the betterment of their immediate environment. Of course, there's a different debate once it comes to slavery and what slaves get out of this. But I think there is a certain cultural difference that is both peculiar and noteworthy in this. It's not that just the ancient Greeks were naive and in thinking that this unitary approach, which is another management theme, that everyone in an organization is expected to go in the same direction and kind of follow this vector set out by management, and any divergence or conflict is seen as deficient and detrimental. And So it wasn't this necessarily. There's more complex factors at play here, but it's still something to be aware of, that organizations at that time had a very different role to play in the society and in the community than they do now, which is, if they want to, no role at all. And then, of course, you only have the reward for work in a sense of what you earn, and nothing more, which is not tremendously motivating, as we know from a lot of human relations work and kind of sociology of work and anthropology on related issues.
I mean, something else that I think makes a big difference between Xenophon's worldview and ours is that, you know, we've been talking about all these people who are in leadership positions, but if you think about each case, so you have, let's say, the householder who's in charge of the estate, you have the king who's in charge of the city. He's giving us an exemplar of that in this very dialogue, Cyrus, right, who would have been a great ruler. You have the general in charge of the army. Then you have God in charge of the universe. He doesn't mention that here, but as I say, that's a motif in ancient Greek literature, that's another parallel case. In none of these situations is the legitimacy of the ruler dependent on how well they carry out their role. So, and this is something that's very clear in the household. So one of the things that gets discussed between, I guess, Ischomachus and Socrates is, Socrates says, well, can you explain to me what is going wrong in households that don't make very much money? And Ischomachus says, well, basically, it's disorganized leadership, right? It's when the householder isn't keeping track of things, isn't like going around to check, isn't being orderly, isn't being neat, and so on. But never do you get the idea that, for example, the workers would be remotely empowered or justified in overthrowing the household, or the slaves can't say, you know what, you're an incompetent householder, I'm off to the next estate. The wife is also just assumed to be obedient. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the flourishing of the organization at each level, whether it's the household, the city state, or the universe, of course, in the universe, the ruler is God, so everything's always run with divine providence, the best it could be. But when humans are involved, if things go well, it's because the ruler is good. If things go badly, it's because the ruler is bad. But a bad ruler is still the ruler. And there's, in a way, nothing anybody can do about it. And you can maybe see here why the democratic people of Athens weren't so happy with Xenophon, right? So he's not a democrat. He's an autocrat who thinks that the autocrat should rule by getting everyone to buy into his way of doing things. And that, in general, is something you see very commonly in Greek political theory. So even in Plato himself, in the Republic, right, the idea is that you put philosophers in charge of the city because they know what they're doing, and everyone else is supposed to do what they say. He's very against democracy. He thinks democracy is the second worst form of government, right, just ahead of tyranny. And in general, when we draw these parallels between the household and the city, there's a similar idea, like the householding husband is just unquestionably in charge, just like the king would be unquestionably in charge. And just as, you know, the monarchical state will be good if the king is virtuous, so the household will be good if the householder is virtuous. But if there's no virtue, then things just go badly, and that's all there is to say about it.
Yeah, it's kind of a classical approach to leadership, that in that you don't question who the ruler is. You can question their performance, you know, how well they're doing, but the fact that they are the ruler is unquestionable.
Yeah, whereas, and so like in the modern company, obviously the shareholders can fire the board, or people could even be sent to jail, or, you know, brought up on charges of corporate malfeasance, etc. Generals could be deposed, even presidents can be impeached, right? And so we're not really fond of these organizations where the leader is in charge for good and there's nothing anybody can do about it, even if they're complete jerks. But of course, in the ancient and medieval worlds, that's pretty much the standard solution. And so it's very striking that in antiquity, and especially in the Middle Ages, one of the most common forms of political literature is the work of advice for the ruler. So you have the philosopher saying, oh, you know, you're the ruler, you're the king, let me tell you how to be a good king.
Right.
And I'll try to convince you that things will go well for you and for the state if you're virtuous. But of course, if you're not virtuous, then it's just bad news for everybody. And there's nothing we could do about it.
Yeah, like the prince, thereabouts. Well, and I wonder if that's not an outgrowth of the fact that a lot of the literature, you know, writing and the time for writing was either a rich man's pursuit or something that was funded by rich people, right? So you weren't going to do very well from an income perspective if you were telling the reader, telling rulers, yeah, you could be deposed by the people who you lead if you don't do very well.
Yeah, I mean, in our terms, all the philosophical and political literature of antiquity in the Middle Ages is by the so-called 1%.
Right. Right?
I mean, even to be literate means you're in the 1%. But also, it's just realistic, right? I mean, if you live in the Roman Empire, then, you know, bad emperors and good emperors come and go.
Right.
And that's just the way it is. Or if you live in medieval Europe, the king is whoever the king is, and there's not that much anybody can do about it, least of all a philosopher. So what the philosopher can do is at least try to convince the king to be nice. And in a way, their roots of that are already detectable here in Xenophon, I think.
Right, but keep in mind that this has a lot to do with ownership, that the ruler of the household, king or a god, they preside over what they own directly. They're not appointed by some owner to manage it on their behalf. So the position of that kind of an entity has very different implications from, you know, board deciding that the CEO is inadequate and replacing with a different CEO. And it's also important in this regard to remember that management as a class only emerged in the early 20th century and late 19th century, and not in the least through the works of people like our good old friend Freddie Taylor or Henri Fayol, who worked hard to institutionalize and outline what management is. What is its role relative to both the employees and the owners, and what are the responsibilities that they can legitimately exercise on behalf of the owners? It was a whole process that went through turning foremen into managers, because foremen are still fundamentally same old employees who are just kind of a bit more entrusted and better, maybe knowledgeable about the work that they do. And but managers are a whole different class. They are specialists. They are the early archetypes of knowledge workers, and they represent owners as opposed to workers. And so in this sense, while Xenophon does mention that there were foremen who were in line with the slaves, there are no managers in this at this time, at least not something that we would recognize as managers these days. And I concur that, yeah, it can seem tempting to extrapolate some of these roles as managers today, but we should really be careful in that. In the same sense as developing skills is not human resource management, then directing work of small teams or small gangs is not management, and there is much more to the management class than kind of these roles and tasks that foremen or something akin to that would do, and that management really only began, you know, just over 100 years ago at the tail end of the Third Industrial Revolution. So kind of in this sense, thinking of employees, slaves, or any kind of subordinates overthrowing an incompetent leader, that's kind of more akin to, you know, something far more sinister, like theft or stuff that's far more illegal than just a legitimate impeachment of an incompetent leader.
Or a slave revolt, maybe. It would be a slave revolt, right?
Right, yeah. Which they feared greatly.
They sure did, and it happened, right?
Right.
Spartacus.
But there's also the kind of this an important difference in terms of what it means to be a member of an organization. I mean, we're talking about slave, and I'm not talking about owning slaves so much as being responsible for the entirety of the slave. Like, if you're a member of an organization now, there it probably differs according to the organization as to just how much you are committed to the organization versus how much the organization is committed to you. And most employment is basically you have the job and then you have the home life. And as we were kind of, as a matter of fact, this was a theme in the previous episode with Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax, where essentially, you know, those two were very, very different. And there's hidden costs associated with whose responsibility is it to take care of the people. So, like, we can talk about, you know, whether we like the fact that there was slave owning. But one of the things that's kind of interesting as a contrast is that essentially the head of the household head of the farm too, had responsibility for the slave total person. You know, and then we look at now it's a matter of, well, the company doesn't want to pay for the livelihood of its employees. Certain things are, you know, pushed to the government or pushed to some other entity. And when you're the individual, the member of the firm along with member of the society, and you're not getting nobody's providing you with what you need in order to survive beyond just, you know, a pay, then that's a source of stress, and that causes a different kind of a problem.
That actually puts a very interesting spin on this whole idea, and thinking of assets as being those things which are of benefit to their owner, and possessions as being just everything else, and even stuff that is potentially detrimental. It's an interesting analytical lens through which to observe the current gig economy and the 0 hours contracts and this kind of flexible work that we've been discussing in the previous episode and in episode 18, and on which we're going to have an event in December. And specifically, if what I have in mind is that, you know, these companies, they essentially aim to have as few employees as possible. So you know, Uber is not supposed to employ any taxi drivers, and Deliveroo is not supposed to employ any delivery people. And everyone who does that work for them, they are classified as independent contractors, with some exceptions of recent court cases where some of these have been shown that no, these people are actually employees because they do the same kind of work for you over and over again. But that's besides the point. So, taking this lens that Xenophon offers here by means of Socrates, these companies, then what they're basically saying is that the people are not assets to them. They're essentially saying that they do not use people well, or they don't know how to use people to the advancement of their cause. So they kind of discharge them from the things that they have and try to optimize the assets that they have. And we know that many of these companies are actually tech companies, and their assets in the Socratic sense, as in that which brings you good, are mainly algorithms. And then what I'm thinking of with regards to this is that a few decades ago, there was this movement in management which, and like Charles Handy was one of the people advocating it by means of his Shamrock organizational design, which is where you leave the core plus a couple of fundamental capabilities, but basically strip down organization to the bare minimum, bare fundamentals, the stuff that you can't do without. So the knowledge center and a couple of absolutely critical departments or areas of specialization. And then you essentially outsource the rest, thus maximizing your both return on investment and also, of course, the effort with which work is done. And it looks great on paper. And this now, having read this, is just straight out of Xenophon. It's that So, okay, so let's minimize possessions and maximize assets. And
yeah, so this is like the beginning of the dialogue, which feels more like a Platonic Socratic dialogue, when Socrates says, well, I hardly have anything, and so I'm very free to do whatever I want, right? So because I have so little property, no one's expecting me to actually, for example, sacrifice to the gods generously, because everybody knows that I can't, right? And in fact, if you take this to the limit, which some people did in imitation of Socrates, I mean, Socrates was famous for going around barefoot. He didn't wear nice clothes. He just hung around in the marketplace, right? And in imitation and exaggeration of him, you have a whole school of philosophers called the Cynics, the most famous of whom is Diogenes the Cynic, who is basically homeless by choice. So he lives in a big wine jar and he begs for food. He's just an indigent guy who is also a philosopher. And what he says is, well, I've chosen this lifestyle because it's given me supreme self-sufficiency and self-mastery, right? I don't have to do anything anyone tells me to do because I have nothing, right? So I can't lose anything. And I live by nature like an animal, right? In fact, the reason they were called cynics is because it's related to the Greek word for dog, kunos. So they live like dogs. And that idea that, I mean, obviously this is a little bit more radical than Uber and their business model, but that idea that you kind of strip things down and divest yourself of assets in order to become self-sufficient is, although in the case of the cynics, very extreme, in another way, it's actually quite familiar.
Well, and I also think it's paradoxical when you were describing it, because this idea that they're self-sufficient, but they have to beg for food and you know, potentially shelter and depend on others. I mean, I think it's self-sufficient in a very narrow sense, that you don't have social obligations, but you actually depend on other people.
Yeah, although there's a very strong current in cynicism of, you know, being able to get by on almost nothing. And the idea is, well, nature will provide you with what you really need. You know, you can sort of forage for food. Actually, there's one of the many, many great anecdotes about Diogenes. I could spend the whole rest of the time telling you anecdotes about Diogenes, but I will restrain myself and just tell you one. There's a story about someone comes upon him begging for money or food from a statue. and they say, Diogenes, what are you doing? And he says, I am practicing being rejected.
Oh, man. From the statue.
Yeah. So he, you know, the cynics were comfortable with the fact that they might sometimes have to go without. You know,
that's fascinating.
That was part of their self-sufficiency.
Right. Practicing being rejected or ignored, actually, is more like, because I'm not sure a statue could reject you, but you're certainly getting ignored. Yeah.
Actually, this is an amazing and very pervasive thing in ancient philosophy. So even the Epicureans, so, you know, if you go by the word Epicurean the way we use it today, they're always often thought to be, you know, like pleasure-seeking hedonists,
yes,
and
yes,
love feasts and so on. And they were pleasure-seeking hedonists, but Epicurus's advice was, if you want pleasure, then train yourself to live on nothing but very simple food and water.
Uh-huh.
Because you get, when you're really hungry and thirsty, you get lots of pleasure from eating plain bread and water. And if you train yourself to only want delicacies and fancy food and nice clothing and shelter and everything, then you'll constantly be in anxiety that you might lose these things. And it's a lot of work. And so actually you get less pleasure overall if you train yourself to want luxuries than if you train yourself to want very little. So there's a great line where he says, when I say that we should be seeking pleasures, I do not mean the pleasures of fish and young boys.
Ooh, so, that's creepy.
So presumably meaning you shouldn't, I'm not talking about fancy food and pederasty. I'm talking about, you know, the simplest pleasures you can get.
Right, but that doesn't hold quite as much these days as it did for ancient Greeks, that people can't just abstain from participating in society. The social forces and the governmental institutions and mechanisms are such that they will try to rope people in, depending on where you are, of course, but a number of countries have strong social welfare safety nets, and there are programs to put people through training, sometimes whether they want it or not, to prepare them for the economy and participation in society. I mean, our ethos of what counts as a citizen is completely different from that of ancient Greeks, where a citizen would be a male landowner, whereas now it's virtually everyone. And the benefits and obligations that come with being a citizen are also different. Even the entire concept of democracy and what it is, what is its form and what it does is completely different. It would not be recognizable to people in ancient Athens, which is a good thing because their democracy was terrible and it excluded so many people. And it just would not be counted as democratic these days. But anyway, this also precludes a different set of relationships between managers and employees, and owners and managers, and owners and employees, and the capital as well.
I mean, obviously there are. I mean, the modern equivalent of the cynics would be like hippie dropouts, right? So this kind of countercultural idea does still exist, but you're right that it would be hard to run a Fortune 500 company while living as a cynic.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up another theme that struck me, and this is in chapter 17, pages 130 to 132, and this has to do with where Ischomachus is talking about the fact that in farming on an annual basis you have some degree of natural variability. Some years you have bumper crops and some years you don't. And then unlike in manufacturing, of course, you can always manufacture goods. And if you have problems one year, you can still create surpluses or whatever. But, given the farming, there's a lot more risk involved because if you have a bad year, then you're going to starve. And kind of the question or the element of the dialogue that was discussed was, well, how do you manage that? And I thought it was interesting that the answer was essentially to stay the course, essentially do the same thing year in, year out, and not try to overdo things one year in anticipation of a great year and underdo things another year in anticipation of a bad year, but just basically take the risk of farming and spread it out as evenly as possible. And if you're virtuous, yeah, you'll go down some downturns, but you'll also have – it'll even out in the end and you'll be okay. There was – and I thought that was kind of striking because it just told me it signaled to me sort of like a conservative approach in line with the concepts of order or what have you, that the Greeks – we're not going to look to try to expand too rapidly or what have you. They were going to just try to keep things steady and just make sure that things were working okay rather than take unnecessary chances. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
It goes along with Xenophon's general very optimistic attitude. So again, when Socrates says, well, why is it that sometimes farms fail and households do badly? The answer is always because the householder lacks virtue.
Right.
And there's another point at which I think as Socrates says, well, of course, the gods do reward the virtuous. So if you're...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There is this, he brings in the aspect of divine providence in addition, right? That the god, if you're virtuous and you're doing, like Tom said, the staying the course, that the gods will reward that. So not only optimistic, but along the fatalistic side, because I was thinking when Tom was talking about that a conservative approach to farming, yeah, that works, except in when you have a drought or, you know, some kind of climate change or something, and then that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, again, these are rich people talking to rich people. So these are not people who are one bad harvest away from penury and starvation. These are people with money in the bank and they can ride out a drought, you know.
Right, and that's one of the things I was thinking about. Demetrius was talking about the contrast between agriculture and industry or manufacturing, and I was thinking Xenophon has a very, very much a rich man's view that you sort of have this bucolic life on the farm and the estate, and that's more virtuous than because they do talk about the sort of some of the negative aspects of being in the manufacturing trade. So clearly he has very little respect for blacksmithing or somebody who works in copper or those kinds of skills.
Actually, the whole text really, I think, and in fact, our conversation about the text is a wonderful illustration of something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, which is roughly to what extent can you learn something and kind of find insights, or should you be open to finding insights in texts that express a lot of attitudes that you find completely repugnant? So yes, in this case, yes. You know, we mentioned, okay, slavery has come up many times. He takes slavery to be such a kind of obvious feature of daily life that he doesn't even bother to try to justify it. The attitudes of the man towards the woman is at best something like the attitude of an adult towards a promising child, right?
Right, overprotective at the very least. Overprotective,
doesn't even begin to cover it. Like, she's not even supposed to go outside, right? So, like right. I said, it's a bit like the Taliban.
Yeah, but partly because it's bad for her, right? So it's not exactly, just we don't want her outside. It's bad for her nature.
Which, of course, is exactly what the Taliban would say, right?
Yes, of course.
So, I mean, and so I think that it's an interesting and something that people think about too little, actually, is, and maybe it's in our face a little bit more with a text like this, because it's about how society was structured and how households worked. But I think in general, we should think more about what we're doing when we look to these ancient texts and think, oh, that's an interesting idea about, yeah, like having everything orderly in the galley of a ship. That's a good point. I could sort of use that idea to help run my company better or to understand management style. I mean, in some sense, I agree with that. I think it's a good idea. I mean, I'm a historian of philosophy, right? I spent all my time reading very carefully these sexist, racist texts. But I think we shouldn't overlook or, you know, forget that at the same time, a lot of genuine insights about how to run organizations in this case might be coexisting cheek by jowl with some really repugnant attitudes, which we don't, I think we shouldn't necessarily just kind of excuse or gloss over just because it's ancient Greece. Because, you know, I mean, this is a time when democracy was on the table and Xenophon rejected it.
Right. I agree with you, Peter, that you don't, I think it's unwise to take the whole text and throw it out because they've got some traditionalist or classical views of these issues that you talked about. That I'm a qualitative researcher, so that I very much believe that you can look at something like this and recognize, okay, parts of it are not applicable to me today or in our society, or, you know, we hold different values, but there's these other parts, these, what do you want to call it, kernels of insight or wisdom, where you can say, yeah, I can see how that would apply without necessarily discounting everything the person has to say. And there's a stream of literature, you know, critical literature, and some stuff you see in the press where people say, okay, I can find this one part that's not applicable, therefore I'll throw out the entire passage or the entire written work, which I think is a mistake because, like you said, it closes us off to the insight, the very real insight that actually exists there. So I think that was a good point.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 37. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying our discussion. And if you are, please share the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. Leave us a review on iTunes or any other platform you're listening on. Also, get in touch. Tell us what you think. We really love to receive feedback from our listeners, and a lot of the times it's really constructive stuff that we're taking on board. Also, if you're enjoying the things that Peter is saying, please go and check out his podcast, History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps and History of Philosophy in India, both of which are incredible. They're super entertaining and highly educational. As I mentioned in part one, this is kind of where I started learning most of my philosophy from initially. And I would highly recommend it to anyone philosophically curious within our community. I'd also like to remind that we are holding our very first event on 15th of December. Now, registration has been closed, but if you really want to come and you're a listener of the podcast, drop us a line and we'll see if we can find a way to welcome you there. So, please join us next week as we conclude this discussion of the ancient Greek text by Xenophon, which is possibly also the very first text in management. Could we say that? Is this fair? We'll see. Next week, here on Talking About Organizations.